So this person spent quite a bit of time in the commission of this monstrous act.
Hi, y'all. I'm Vincent, host of Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime. Each week, we take a thorough look at lesser-known unsolved cases throughout the Lone Star State, hear victims' stories as told by their loved ones, and expert insight from law enforcement and medical professionals.
You know, using a hatchet, that's an extremely violent and rageful type of act.
The truth is out there somewhere, and you can help us find it.
You know, before I die, I want to know who did it.
Please join us as we examine forgotten Texas cases. Subscribe and listen to Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, on your favorite podcatcher.
There are monsters among us.
Southern Fraud True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. My fault is past, but oh, what form of prayer can serve my turn? Forgive me my foul murder. Thou cannot be, since I am still possessed of those effects for which I did the murder. That was a passage from Shakespeare's Hamlet, Act 3, Scene 3. It's Claudius's tormented soliloquy, pondering his possible repentance for the murder of his brother. It's one of the bard's most famous speeches, and it had an unexpected effect on a 17-year-old high school senior in Fort Worth, Texas. As her friend was reciting those words, Marie Robards turned a whiter shade of pale and began weeping. She had a secret so dark it had been festering for over a year. To her friend's astonishment, crying and trembling, Marie Robards confessed that she had poisoned her own father. Welcome to episode 46, Patricide. Thy name is Marie Robards. Fort Worth, affectionately known as Cowtown, is located in northern Texas. Established in 1849, named for General William Jenkins Worth, Camp Worth began as an army outpost, facing the North Bluff looking over the Clear Fork of the Trinity River. It was the northernmost of 10 forts designed to protect the American frontier after the Mexican-American War. But as far as America is concerned, it's where the West begins. During the 1860s and 1870s, Fort Worth was the king of the cattle industry, cementing its nickname as Cowtown. The Texas and Pacific Railway came to Fort Worth in 1876, further growing the cattle industry and the building of the infamous stockyards. Fort Worth became home to the largest meatpacking operations in the West, attracting the two largest meatpacking firms, Armour and Swift, to the stockyards. Naturally, a red light district sprang up. Known as Hell's Half Acre, it is infamously the basis for most notions of the Wild West you see in pop culture. Cowboys and outlaws passing through usually headed down to Hell's Half Acre for a drink and a show and maybe a bit of gambling in the dance halls and saloons. Known simply as the Acre today, that area is still bustling in downtown Fort Worth with live music, restaurants, and numerous gift shops. Touting itself as the city of cowboys and culture, Fort Worth is home to a vibrant local arts scene, world-class museums, and the world's first and largest indoor rodeo. Fort Worth also played a part in the huge oil boom of Texas. The city was located between two of the biggest oil gusher discoveries in Texas and is home to several refineries. There are also over 1,000 natural gas wells, making Fort Worth a major player in the oil and gas industries. It's also home to headquarters for many diverse companies, from American Airlines to Pier 1 Imports. After more than 170 years of economic changes and growth, Fort Worth has stayed intrinsically Cowtown, retaining its Western heritage while also embracing 21st century diversity. Stephen Robards and Beth Lomer had grown up in Fort Worth and were high school sweethearts. They married in 1974, right after Steve signed on for a four-year tour of duty in the Navy. Dorothy Marie Robards was born July 10, 1976, to the young couple. She would remain their only child. Stephen, Beth, and the baby they called Marie moved around to a couple of different Navy bases before returning to Fort Worth in 1979. Just 1 year later, Beth and Stephen separated, and Marie went to live with her mother. Beth later talked to journalist Skip Hollinsworth for his preeminent article on the case called Poisoning Daddy, which was published in Texas Monthly Magazine in July of 1996. Beth characterized her ex-husband as a depressive. He had extreme bouts of darkness and also had trouble holding down a job. She said he was jealous and had a temper. She called their relationship a teenage whirlwind romance. But once the pressures of career, marriage, and parenting hit, the relationship crumbled. In 1981, Beth remarried to a man named Frank Burroughs. He was a former Navy officer that she met while stationed in Florida with Stephen and Marie. She said that they were just friends during that time, but after the Navy, Frank got a job as a police officer in Granbury, Texas, and the two started dating. Granbury is a small town with less than 8,000 residents that's just about an hour from Fort Worth. Frank was also recently divorced and brought a son close to Marie's age to the relationship. He was an authoritarian type and let both children know that if they ever moved out to go and live with their other parent, they were not allowed to move back home. I am a full-time step-parent myself who has also instated this rule. I had friends who were children of divorce growing up, and I watched them seesaw between homes. You get mad at mom, you go move in with dad. Dad pissed you off, so you're back at mom's. It sets a bad precedent and teaches children how to be manipulative. It's also an exhaustive merry-go-round that perpetuates the fighting and bad feelings between exes. Many blended families lay down this same rule to avoid it. But Frank and Beth Burroughs had no way of knowing that this rule would send Marie into a dangerous spiral. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. Marie Robards was a good girl. The quintessential good girl. She played clarinet in the school band and also took art and dance classes for extracurricular activities. She had a few close friends and stayed out of trouble. She was regarded as shy. Her mother said she was so intelligent that she was writing in cursive by kindergarten. She lived in Granbury with her mom and stepdad, and she saw her dad, Stephen, rarely. He lived in Fort Worth in a one-bedroom apartment, still struggling with keeping jobs, so Marie only visited once or twice a month. A psychologist later hired by Marie's defense attorneys said there were some issues in her young life. She was jealous of Frank and possessive of her mother. But Dr. J. Randall Price also capitulated that Frank was probably jealous of the close relationship between Marie and his wife. Dr. Price said Beth and Marie behaved more like sisters than mother and daughter. Marie was very attached to her mother and very protective. Beth said that the weekend before Marie turned 16, she came home and found Frank in bed with another woman. Marie was furious and immediately told her mother. But then she was taken aback when Beth didn't leave Frank. Beth worked in a busy emergency room at a hospital and blamed her long hours for Frank's infidelity. But Marie saw him for what he was and loudly voiced her frustrations that her mother would not leave him or kick him out. Marie started withdrawing from the family and smarting off to Frank whenever she felt like it. She couldn't stand her stepfather now. She finally gave her mother an ultimatum. Divorce him, or she was moving out. Her mother refused to divorce Frank. Marie said, "Then I have to leave." Beth's parents lived in Fort Worth, and rather than sending Marie to live with her real dad, she made arrangements for her to live with her grandparents. Beth enrolled Marie in a new high school and promised to stay in close contact. But just 5 days after she arrived in Fort Worth, Marie took a $50 cab ride back to Granbury and showed up at Beth and Frank's front door. To her dismay, Frank refused to let her stay. He had made that rule and meant to stick by it. His son had chosen to go and live with his mother recently. It hadn't worked out, and Frank had refused to let him move back. Beth would later describe a horrible scene, with everyone screaming at each other and Marie crying. She said it made her feel like Frank was making her choose between him or Marie. I can see why she felt that way, but I can also see Frank's point, seeing as how he had refused his own son. Frank was a strict disciplinarian, but obviously his affair had cost him authority. Marie didn't just lose respect for her stepfather, she loathed him. And now he was standing between her and her mother. In the end, Beth chose to abide by Frank's rule. She admitted that she really thought the situation would be temporary. That after Marie went to live in Stephen's small apartment for a while, Frank would relent and let her move back. But that's not how things went. Marie later told her psychologist that she felt abandoned, and she also thought that Frank was relieved to be rid of her. Frank may well have felt some relief, but he didn't really show it. He tried to be supportive to his wife, but firm in his values. Stephen Robards, on the other hand, was thrilled. He hadn't lived with his teenage daughter since she was 3 years old, and his life had really taken a change for the better recently. His depression was better with new medication, and he got a job working as a postman and even had a new lady in his life, another single mother who lived in his apartment building named Sandra Hudgens. He quickly applied for a two-bedroom apartment at the complex he lived at, but for the time being, Marie slept in a rollaway bed that stayed under the dining room table. It obviously wasn't ideal, but it's not like Stephen had a lot of time to prepare. He was doing the best he could. He took Marie out to dinner and to the movies and tried to make his daughter happy and comfortable with him. Sandra Hudgens later said it didn't matter. Marie was constantly on the phone with her mother, begging to come back home. She also wrote her mother all the time, complaining about Steve's cooking, the small apartment, and she hated her new high school, Eastern Hills. She even wrote to Beth claiming she was suicidal. Beth immediately called her daughter, but really just wrote it off as Marie being overly dramatic. A few months passed, and finally it seemed to everyone that Marie was adjusting. Her grades had gone up significantly, and she was once again an A student. Her teachers later described her as cheerful. Stephen's girlfriend Sandra said by Christmas, Marie really seemed settled. She never disrespected her father and was friendly with Sandra. Sandra said, quote, "In all honesty, she was what you wanted a teenager to be." But either Marie was doing a good job of hiding her real feelings, or what she did that following February was on impulse. While in chemistry class, she poured barium acetate from a bottle into a napkin and then hid the napkin in her backpack. Barium acetate is a white powder which dissolves quickly. It's used in textile printing, paint drying, and in lubricating oil. In chemistry, it's used in the preparation of other acetates and as a catalyst in organic synthesis. It's also a deadly poison, not easily detected because it can present as a cardiac event. Marie would always insist that she had only meant to make her father ill. She felt trapped in the situation with her dad, mom, and Frank. It wasn't so much that she wanted to hurt Stephen, she just wanted to go home to her mom. She had even considered setting fire to his apartment when he wasn't there. But instead, on the evening of February 18, 1993, she poisoned her father. Stephen had gotten Mexican takeout for dinner that night, and when he went to the fridge for a soda, she mixed some of the barium into his refried beans. When they finished dinner, Steve left to go to a Wednesday night service at his church. He was home less than an hour later saying his stomach hurt. Then he started vomiting. Marie went and got Sandra, telling her that her dad was sick. She stayed in Sandra's apartment as Sandra went to go check on Stephen. By then, he said his arms were seizing up and getting stiff, and he couldn't swallow. Sandra quickly called an ambulance. She later described a horrific death, with Stephen foaming at the mouth, struggling to breathe. Paramedics got there quickly, but it was too late. His throat had closed, and they couldn't get an oxygen tube in. Though he was taken to the hospital, he was already dead. The poison worked quickly. Sandra said that as paramedics took her father away, Marie stood at the door, looking as if she was in shock. Sandra said she went to Marie and hugged her, pushing her face into her shoulder so she wouldn't have to watch her father die. And hours later, Marie got her way. When Frank and Beth showed up at the hospital, to take her back home to Granbury. At this time, I'm going to pause for a final word from today's sponsor. Most people who lose weight end up gaining it all back. It's because most weight loss plans tell you what to do when you're on the plan, not after. Let me tell you about Noom. You will lose the guilt and develop a new relationship with food. If you want different results, you gotta try something new. With Noom, you build new, better habits, and you can recognize and change your bad habits. With the Noom app on your phone, you've got support in the palm of your hand whenever you need it. You can visualize portion sizes, track your meal habits, and check calories at a glance. Personally, I need to lose some weight, but I also want to change my habits. I have high blood pressure, and even though it's a hereditary issue, holding myself accountable with food is just as important as medication. Noom is designed for results. Out with the old and in with the new. Sign up for your trial today at Noom, Noom.com/southernfried. What are you waiting for? Visit Noom.com/southernfried to start your trial today. Again, that's Noom.com/southernfried to start losing weight for good today. Is there not rain enough in the sweet heavens to wash it white as snow? Whereto serves mercy but to confront the visage of offense? If Marie Robards felt guilty about killing her father, no one noticed. The visage she showed the world was that of a teenager in shock. She stood numb at her father's graveside, and no one was the wiser. After the funeral, her mother pulled her aside and told her she was still having marital problems with Frank and had decided to leave him. She was moving to Panama City, Florida, and planned to take Marie with her. Incredulous, Marie replied, "You had this plan all along to take me to Florida?" Beth told her she had found a job there and they were going to be together again, just the two of them. She said Marie looked like she couldn't breathe when she told her. She probably thought her daughter's reaction was because she was still reeling from Stephen's sudden death, which had been ruled a heart attack. Chest pains, arm pains, nausea, and shortness of breath are all symptoms of a heart attack. The coroner that examined Steve Robards did not test his blood for barium acetate. Even if he had thought to do so, he couldn't have. The Tarrant County Coroner's Office didn't have the $150,000 machine needed to detect the poison in a blood test. But Stephen Robards had died suddenly right in front of his own daughter. The police and coroner had no reason to suspect foul play. So he was buried, and his family, while mourning the loss of the young 38-year-old man, went on with their lives. And Marie moved to Panama City with Beth. Beth had gotten a secretarial job for the Department of Motor Vehicles, and she enrolled Marie in a local high school. But pretty much from the moment they arrived in Florida, Marie was severely depressed. Some days were so bad that she couldn't even get out of bed, and Beth was distressed, remembering the bleak depression her ex-husband had suffered from. She worried it was hereditary and sent Marie to a counselor. She tried to give her daughter the space she needed to grieve, while also encouraging her to make new friends and become involved with school activities. That June, just 4 months after Stephen's death and Beth's decision to leave Frank showed up in Panama City. He wanted to get his wife back. And Beth did want to reconcile. He promised to work much harder on their marriage. He moved in with Beth and Marie even seemed more accepting of him this time. More willing to give him another chance. But she stayed suspicious, and snooping, she found a note from another woman in his pillowcase. Outraged, she showed her mother and told her to throw Frank out. Again, Beth refused. For the second time, she chose her cheating husband over her daughter, and Marie was done. She said, quote, "Mom, you can put up with him if you want to, but I don't have to. I miss Texas, and I'm going home." And she was as good as her word. She called Stephen's father Jim, her grandfather, and asked if she could come and live with him and his new wife in Mansfield, Texas. They agreed, and Marie came to live with them, enrolling in Mansfield High School. They never suspected anything was amiss. They did find it odd that she refused to go to Stephen's grave, telling them that she couldn't emotionally handle it. But they didn't push her. Beth later said she believed that Marie wanted to make it up to the Robards family by being the best granddaughter she could. She was determined to start a new life. Once again, Marie Robards was a straight-A student. Her teachers reported that she wanted to be involved in everything, was interested in everything. She excelled at keyboarding, enjoyed drama class, and was interested in journalism. Her classmates were equally impressed with the aloof but beautiful new girl in school. She was a striking girl, tall and thin with brown eyes and long legs. She dressed conservatively, and her shyness was almost preternatural. There were rumors that her dad had died, and that's why she was so reserved, but no one was really sure. And then Marie found herself befriended by one of the most popular girls in their senior class. Stacy High, who was voted most humorous after graduation, felt an unspoken kinship to Marie. She came from an abusive background, and she saw Marie's formality as the sort of armor it was. She intuitively guessed that Marie had gone through something traumatic. They were instant best friends, working on the yearbook staff together, studying often, and just hanging out. Stacy even got Marie to go to a cowboy bar with her in Fort Worth. She later said she often tried to get Marie to talk about her dad because she knew that talking would help, but Marie always shut her down. One night in January 1994, the girls were studying Shakespeare's Hamlet. Stacy rushed ahead and recited her favorite part of Hamlet, Claudius's guilt-ridden soliloquy that I read at the beginning of the show. "Forgive me my foul murder. That cannot be, since I'm still possessed." Marie turned white at these lines as Stacy asked exuberantly, "Isn't that cool?" Marie asked Stacy if she thought people could go through life without a conscience. Stacy said probably the kind of person who could look someone in the eye and still kill them in cold blood. At this, Marie got up and then fell to the floor sobbing. When Stacy asked her what was wrong, Marie said, "Guess." After a couple of teenage questions, including, "Are you pregnant?" Stacy said, "Well, you didn't kill somebody, did you?" Marie whispered, "My father. I poisoned him." And then she begged Stacy not to tell anyone, crying, "You're the only person who knows." Stacy promised to keep her secret, but troubled, she told her mom about it when she got home that night. Libby High initially thought it was teenage dramatics, but was curious enough to call the Poison Control Center hotline and ask if barium acetate could kill a person by closing their throat. Poison Control said yes, it could kill a person, and wanted to know why Libby was asking, but she hung up, and she didn't call the police. She told journalist Skip Hollinsworth, quote, "I wanted Stacy to know that I trusted her to make her own decision about Marie. I guess I knew that this was the moment in which Stacy was going to have to grow up." But Stacy kept Marie's awful secret, going into a deep depression herself for a while. She talked to a school counselor, but not in specifics. She even told a few older kids who had already graduated who just laughed at her, thinking she made up the story. She started having nightmares that Marie was chasing her, but she stayed friends with her, hoping it was just a terrible mistake. She suggested Marie get counseling, and she even told her that she told a priest what Marie had done. But nothing changed. That February in 1994, on the first anniversary of Stephen Robards' death, Marie's grandfather took her and Stacy out to eat. He tried to toast to his son, but Marie wouldn't have it. Stacy asked her if she wanted to go put flowers on her dad's grave, but Marie told her she didn't even know where it was. She said she was over his death and didn't want to think about it. Stacy suffered through a few more guilt-ridden weeks and many more nightmares before she finally went back to the school counselor and told the truth. The counselor called the Fort Worth police. Stacy thought there would be immediate consequences, but she was wrong. As I said before, the Tarrant County Coroner's Office was not equipped to test for barium poisoning. And it wasn't even a matter of exhuming Stephen's body. They kept vials of blood as a matter of lab policy after all autopsies. The deputy coroner later said it took 3 months to find a lab with the right equipment and several more months before they received the results. Skip Hollinsworth speculated in his article, Poisoning Daddy, that perhaps Fort Worth Homicide had more pressing crimes to investigate. Would they actually take an absurd story like this from a teenager seriously? Especially when the victim's death had never been considered suspicious. The weight started getting to Stacy. She wondered if she had made a mistake in telling on Marie and started avoiding her, even quitting the yearbook staff. She also spiraled herself, staying out late drinking and partying with friends. In April, she enrolled herself in a program at a psychiatric center in Mansfield. She still saw Marie occasionally. There's a picture of both girls posing at their senior prom together. But as far as Stacy was concerned, she thought the police either didn't believe her, wouldn't do anything about it, or both. Finally, the girls graduated and, to Stacy's relief, decided to attend different colleges. Marie went to the University of Texas in Austin, while Stacy went to the Sam Houston State University in Huntsville. Stacy said they didn't talk or write after that, and she tried to put it all behind her. But in October, a Fort Worth detective called her dorm to inform her that he would be there in the morning to take her statement. The tests had finally come in. Stephen Robards died from barium poisoning. He had more than 250 times the amount of barium acetate that would normally be found in a person's blood. Fort Worth police arrested Marie, and she readily confessed. Crying, she said she hadn't meant to kill her father. She only wanted to make him sick so she could go back home to her mom. She even typed her confession up herself on the word processor at the station. The first time she appeared in court was October 28, 1994. She was released to her mother's custody until the court could decide whether she should be tried as a juvenile or as an adult. She was indicted on March 30, 1995 for first-degree murder and was to be tried as an adult. She got out on $10,000 bond and moved in with her mom and Frank in Granbury as she awaited her trial. She even waited tables at a TGI Fridays during this time, which is strange seeing as how she was awaiting trial for putting poison in food. Marie Robards went on trial for first-degree murder, finally, in May 1996 when she was 19 years old. Beth used Stephen's life insurance money that Marie had inherited to hire two top Fort Worth defense attorneys, Bill Magnuson and Ward Casey. They made their case around Marie's insistence that she hadn't meant to kill her father. She had only wanted to make him sick so that she could go home to her mom. Marie gave an interview to the press with her lawyers at her side and said, quote, "I was in shock. I knew I had done something very, very wrong, but I did not think of myself as a criminal. I took this chemical from school because I knew it would just make him sick. I just wanted to be with my mom so bad that I would do anything to be with her." She went on to say, "I think for a long time I did a good job of pretending it didn't happen. For a long time I tried not to think about it." She spoke about her constant depression and feelings of guilt, saying, "I feel so guilty about what happened. I know I hurt a lot of people." The prosecutor, Mitch Poe, characterized her as a cold-blooded murderer who knew exactly what she was doing. He pointed out that she could have admitted to paramedics what she had given her father, but didn't. Likely it would have been too late anyway, but his point was, she intended to kill him. He said, quote, "In my opinion, she gave him a death sentence, and I fully believe she intended to do what she did. We believe she deserves the maximum punishment." He also pointed out to the court that she had almost committed the perfect crime. If only she hadn't confessed to Stacy. Stacy High was the prosecution's star witness. Composed and alert, she told about how Marie had confessed and even said Marie told her that she knew barium acetate could be deadly. A teacher named Tracy Arnold testified that the principal at East Hills High School told her not to tell the police that they kept barium acetate in classrooms and that the poison was even hidden before the police searched the lab. Clearly, the school was concerned with liability. And the trial was a circus. Every seat was filled every day. Marie had cut her hair short and wore conservative clothing. She cried silently through most of the testimony, trying to hide her face by putting her hand on her cheek. Curiously, Marie's defense attorneys did not put her psychologist, Dr. Price, on the stand. He was prepared to testify that Marie was not a cold-blooded killer. On the contrary, he believed she was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder from the guilt and grief at what she had done. Marie didn't take the stand either, and without much other testimony in her defense, the jury found her guilty of first-degree murder. But Marie did testify in her own defense at the sentencing portion of her trial. On the stand, she trembled meekly, saying she had never committed another crime. Her lawyer, Ward Casey, asked, "Marie, did you love your dad?" She answered, "Very much." He then asked, "Are you sorry you killed your dad?" And at this, Marie burst into tears, repeating, "I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry," over and over again, while looking at her father's family sitting in the courtroom. But prosecutor Mitch Poe pointed out that just making Stephen sick wouldn't have changed Marie's circumstances. Quote, "One stomach ache wasn't going to get Marie back to her mama's place. Stephen Robards had to die." But the defense did have one witness that swayed the jury. Jim Robards, Stephen's father, took the stand and begged for mercy for his granddaughter. He said that the guilt and anguish that she lived with and would continue to live with was enough. He asked the jurors to give her probation. She was facing life in prison for first-degree murder. It would be 35 years at minimum before she would be eligible for parole. But the jury sentenced Marie Robards to 28 years in prison. Now she would only have to serve 7 years before being eligible for parole. Mitch Poe called Marie a teenage narcissist and a manipulative predator to the press. Marie's attorneys filed an appeal claiming the prosecution used improper testimony about Marie's state of mind. A curious appeal considering they didn't put on their own psychiatric expert. Marie was placed on suicide watch at the jail while pending transport to prison. She talked to her mom every night on the phone and at one point wanted her mom to assure Stacy that she didn't blame her and hoped she didn't feel bad about going to the police. Her appeal was denied in 1998, and Dorothy Marie Robards wound up serving 8 years before being released in 2003. Today she is 42 years old, married, and lives under a different identity. She uses her first name Dorothy, or sometimes Dot, but I won't say her last name for this show. Poison has long thought to be a woman's weapon, but this is just a common myth, perpetuated by pop culture. Some think it started with a Sherlock Holmes movie quote from the 1940s, but you still hear it even today, referenced on popular shows like Game of Thrones. And it does seem to make sense to us. We know that men are more violent, but that doesn't mean they don't also use poison. About 65% of poisonings are done by men. So, as a means of murder, it's not really about violence so much as it is about convenience. And it is most certainly about not getting caught. Most experts believe that homicidal poisoning is much more prevalent than we know. It's much easier to get away with. Symptoms often match those associated with a natural death, as in a heart attack like the medical examiner thought Steve Robards died from. That's the reason prosecutor Mitch Poe kept calling this the almost perfect crime. Had Marie not finally broken down and confessed to Stacy, she would have gotten away with it. Patricide, or the killing of one's father, is statistically rare, especially for a female child. One study I read estimated that over 80% of these killers are male, and the murder is impulsive and violent. Typically, there are three categories these kids or teenagers fit into. One is a severely abused child who often kills to end the abuse. The second category is mental illness, such as schizophrenia. The third is what psychiatrists call an antisocial personality. They kill for purely selfish or instrumental reasons, like for money or freedom, or perhaps to go live with the parent they prefer. I guess if we need to put Marie Robards into a category, then the last one is the most likely. She did kill her father for a selfish reason. She did act out because she didn't get her way. But you'll have to decide for yourself if you think she meant to kill her father. She has always maintained that she only wanted to make him sick. And her family, including her father's family, have always stood behind her on this. I do feel she was appropriately punished. This case is so bizarre. I admit I had trouble deciding how I felt about it at first. Honestly, if she had poisoned her stepdad, Frank Burroughs, instead of her own father, I think this would have been a more open and shut case of first-degree murder. She had plenty of reasons to want to be rid of Frank. He not only cheated on her beloved mother, he refused to let her live with her mom. He was hurting their close relationship. But poisoning her own dad, who had never been anything but kind to her, is inexplicable. And her confession and behavior in court, while definitely strange, I think did reflect her true feelings. And I know that stealing the poison shows premeditation. It definitely wasn't heat of the moment. But knowing teenagers, it still feels like an impetuous, even dramatic move on her part. She was drowning in self-pity. And I also think of how Sandra, Stephen's girlfriend, described Marie standing in shock as her father died. Maybe she knew the poison would kill him, but maybe she thought it would take longer. She did go to Sandra for help immediately once he got sick, and in doing so, the paramedics were called. If she wanted him dead, she simply could have waited. No, I think she thought she would just make him sick. Maybe sick enough for a hospital stay so she could go back to her mom's long enough to convince Frank to let her move back in. And a true psychopath would never have confessed. I do believe she was repentant, but felt hopeless when she finally told her best friend. Perhaps she felt that even if she got away with the murder in this life, a higher judgment still awaited her. As Claudia said in Hamlet, "May one be pardoned and retain the offense in the corrupted currents of this world. Offense's gilded hand may shove by justice, and oft to seen the wicked prize itself buys out the law, but 'tis not so above." Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. Special thanks to journalist Skip Hollinsworth. His long-form article, Poisoning Daddy, was my main source for this episode. There are a few ID channel type episodes on this case, but I've got to mention a fictional novel based on the crime. Megan Abbott wrote Give Me Your Hand based on Marie's story, and it's fantastic. And also thanks to Erica Lee from Gone Cold Podcast for suggesting this fascinating case. I played Gone Cold's promo at the beginning of the show today, and you really should check it out. They explore forgotten yet fascinating cases from the Lone Star State. Honestly, it's by far my favorite podcast. If you love a Southern twang, great music, and a good mystery, please give Gone Cold Podcast a try. Incidentally, I will be in Fort Worth, Texas this Saturday, along with Erica, Vincent, and Christina from Gone Cold, to our podcast meetup at the Yard at 6 p.m. Many of your other favorite podcasters will be there, including Aaron and Shay from All Crime, No Cattle, and Lainey from True Crime Fan Club. Check out the event page on Facebook to find out all of the shows representing. It's going to be a lot of fun, and we hope to see you there. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm on most large platforms like Stitcher and other podcatchers. If you're interested in supporting the show, please visit my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com. There is a link to my Patreon page on there. Patrons of Southern Fried enjoy many rewards like stickers, magnets, and t-shirts, as well as early ad-free listening to episodes. Or if you would like to buy a t-shirt or other merch, you can now directly buy it from my website. And there is also a donate button if you would like to make just a one-time donation. Again, that's southernfriedtruecrime.com. If you have any comments, corrections, or suggestions, you can email me at southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I love hearing from you guys, and I'm always looking for new cases, so please feel free to reach out. I'm also all over social media. Just search the show name in your favorite platform if you'd like to connect with me there. If you're interested in discussing this case or any other episodes further, come check out my discussion group. It's linked to my Southern Fried True Crime Facebook page. We don't just discuss cases. We share memes, make friends, talk about current events and crime, and laugh at all things Southern. We'd love to have you. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.